and turns the machine on, and it's one of these YouTube displays. Beautiful thing to watch. And he goes through the explanation, and he shows you the schematic diagram of how he built the thing. And his basic exciter for the primary coil at the bottom is a spark gap generator. High voltage going into a spark gap generator, and that's what fires up the primary. The secondary was, I think he said, 3,000 turns of something like a 34-gauge wire, and that center post looked to me like it was about 4 feet tall, with a great big ball on the top, and the spark coming out of there would jump to the walls of the garage, and some of those sparks looked to me like at least 7 or 8 feet long. You calculate what kind of voltage we're talking about here, and I bet you he's in the 5 megavolt capability, KQLIW.
He's a Ford coil, Vic.
No, that wasn't a Ford. There was another version with a guy with a Ford coil. Now, this was a supersized Tesla coil where the primary is fired with a spark gap circuitry being fired with, I think he put something like 3,000 or 5,000 volts through a spark gap into the primary, spark gap circuitry, very similar to the old-fashioned transmitters. Yes, Ford spark coils will give you a big voltage, but this thing, was there a Ford spark coil there also? Maybe you saw the same movie. Back to you, Mel.
Well, that was the driver. I used the Ford coil. That was my driver. And the coil, yes, the same, came out of the same. It was the magazine also. And I wound the coil. Oh, boy, I wound it with around a, it was a plastic, gee, what was it from? I don't even remember what the heck the plastic pipe was from, the tube was from at the time. It wasn't PVC because it didn't exist. It was a thin plastic. I'm trying to remember what I got that from. And it stood about, that plastic piece that I wound the coil, oh, it was at least 4 feet long or more. And I wound, oh, jeez, thousands of turns on it. I made a whole thing up there and all between. Oh, they gave you a whole idea how to do it. You made up the 2 points to pivot and how to turn it and everything with a hand crank thing to wind the coil. It was a whole deal. But the Ford coil was the initial source of the high voltage spark pitch.
W2CUK.
Okay, CUK recognized. Bill, we'll get to you in a second. The Ford spark coil, though, I think is only running at the couple watt level. This guy was running at something like 5 kilowatts into the primary. And boy, was he making sparks. On a quick break, Mel, how many feet of what gauge wire was that secondary winding? And did you have to do splicing to get that much wire on that piece of tubing?
Oh, what I did, you know how you know where you got the wire from? It was like number 30 wire. And what you did is salvaged it. In those days, the speakers, the old speakers used to have the electromagnetic voice coil. Had a, some of them, you know, you had a huge coil on there. It was like a couple of, maybe 3-4 inches in diameter and about 2 or 3 inches wide on some of those big speakers. They used them in, back to speaker. My uncle brought it to me. He worked in a place where they had jukeboxes. And those were the electromagnetic speakers used in jukebox. I used to take those coils, those huge coils off. Remember, they didn't have a PM speakers in those days. And that was the source of the coil wire. And, there was a lot of wire on that. And I made it one more than enough for that coil to go over.
Just one speaker, or did you have to do some splicing?
Oh, just one. Oh, boy, that coil. Let me tell you something. That coil was a good few pounds of copper. And I would say there was good, easy 10 pounds of copper there. It was a huge coil that was on those old electromagnetic speakers, the ones, the big ones. I could say that coil was easily maybe 3.5-4 inches in diameter and about, and the width, you know, it was in the center, right through the center was a core. And the width of it was at least 3 or 4 inches. So there was a lot of wire there, Dick.
And that plastic core, was that something that a rug was wound on?
You know, I don't remember. It was a core that was about maybe 3 inches in diameter. I remember it was black. It was black plastic. And I remember I made for each end. They told you how to do it. Each end you made up like a a piece of round piece of wood that you put in there, and you made the pivots. You had to make like a pivot on each end there, and all, and one end you put a thing with like a belt, with like a small belt, and they showed you how to make the crank, you know, the hand crank it and everything like that, and how to, you know, feed the wire across. It was a whole, every Popular Electronics used to have all those different projects, Van de Graaff, Tesla coils, you name it. They used to constantly run those projects, Dick. In fact, I built also the, from that one of those articles was the thing, you know, the metal locator. I built the homebrew metal locator, which I've had a lot of fun with over.
Well, I was also a epileptica guy. I was also a subscriber to Popular Electronics. Now, Bill was a lecturer's student in the B2C UK. I bet you you've built a Van de Graaff generator once or twice in your life. Is that true, Bill? Go ahead.
No, Dick, I haven't. But I have been in a home of someone who had Tesla coils dear to her heart, and which I understand a couple of times went over at least 4 foot high coils and at least 4 foot, 5 foot sparks. But she took things a little bit to the next level. She would take bulbs, tubes, and irradiate them, hit them with the lightning, and actually get radiation to come off of them. She had these little radiation monitors that she would have on, around the area, and when the bolt of lightning would hit these bulbs, it would light up like radiation being released. So high voltage can be dangerous. She also had something called Geissler tubes, which I think that's the name of them, where they would glow different colors when they were hit by these bolts of lightning. But this was really amazing in our house there. She had this set up. And I remember my last public demonstration of high voltage was in the Boston Science Museum, where they actually, I guess it was a Tesla coil, it was lightning. It was 8, 10 feet long, bolts of lightning, and the guy, I don't remember if it was someone from the audience or the guy from the museum, stood in a Faraday cage, letting this lightning hit him all around, and that was pretty fascinating, and it was loud, and it was very interesting. This had to be in the 70s. I don't know if they saw that show, but that was in the Boston Science Museum. But, yeah, the high voltage is fascinating, and I've never really gotten into it, though, you know. You discharge all this lightning with sensitive electronics around, you may not have your HF or your 2-meter radio left after discharging all these sparks. Dick, back to you.
Yeah, you're right. You've got to be careful about ESD, electrostatic discharge. Mr. FLF, now give us your full call and name, and then proceed, sir. My name is Dick, T-2-R-I-W.
This is Lionel. Good evening, N2FLF. Name is Mark. Excellent. Science first. Lots of fun can be had there, I tell you. Hey, Dick, what's the name of that thing? You haven't seen them lately. Looks like a clear light bulb. And it has, I think it was four diamond-shaped sides. One side's black and the other side's white, and it was spinning around with sunlight. Was it a
radiometer? They sell radiometers, all sizes. If you look up radiometers on the on a Google search, and you'll find a lot of those things. They're kind of fun. By the way, while you're at the tie-in first, I got sucked up by the Van de Graaff generator. I also bought something called Volter's Hailstorm. It's just about the plastic cage with a great big set of contacts on top and bottom, and you put it just near the Van de Graaff generator when it's running. And the little pith balls you put inside, about 100 of them, jump up and down, and it looks like continuous rain. It's electrostatic repulsion. In other words, from the bottom plate, they get, the negative charge, and they repel each other. They jump up to the top plate. They hit the positive charge. Then they repel each other and jump back down again, and you get this continuous storm of these things going up and down. That's a fun thing. Now, that drinking bird is really cute. I got one of those here for $7. But they sell some awful nice stuff. I don't know who should pick it up. You guys choose. H-U-R-I-W.
Excellent topic tonight.
Really, you were fascinating. I brought a gyroscope there to school.
How big was your gyroscope, and what did you do with it, and how long did it run, Mel?
Well, I had this gyroscope that they sold someplace. It was surplus. They used to use them in torpedoes for torpedoes guidance. and you take it all apart, and what you do is you start it, had a little thing on the end where you start it with a little bit of a little motor. You could get it started, you know, the spinning real fast. And then you balance it on your finger and you turn it this way and that way and all. And then I went ahead and I got that other one that was you made from an old bicycle wheel when they had the thick, you know, the thick tubes, the thick wheels. And what you do is you took a chair, one of the chairs that teacher had, you know, that would be able to turn around, one of those old type office chairs. He's got one of them. He sat the kid down in it, and he got this wheel spinning, and he showed him by turning the wheel that he would turn it to the chair. In other words, he would be able to turn around, change the different position on the chair without just by turning this wheel, you know, different angles, Dick, over.
Yeah, that's a fun experiment. Now, with reference to gyroscopes, I may have asked you this puzzle once before. I went a few years ago and bought a pair of these Edmund Scientific-like gyroscopes. Not super big ones, but a pair of them. I made a wire frame which would allow me to mount the two of them side by side in this wire frame, and they came down to a common point on the wire frame. So now I've got two gyroscopes running side by side, and when I turn them both in the same direction, pull the string on each one of them, turn them in the same direction, you get normal gyroscopic action. The next thing I did is I would turn one clockwise, one counterclockwise, put the common point at the bottom on the little cup, and what do you think happened, Mel?
Let's see. I guess it would stand still. You know, one was turning one way, one was turning the other way. Over.
Good guess. Anybody else got a guess what happened? The amazing thing. I thought I would get, instead of the normal precession of the gyroscope, I thought it would sit absolutely still. Uh-uh. Turn one clockwise, one counterclockwise, turn them at the same rate, the two of them side by side, locked together in this metal frame, and they come down to a common point at the bottom. With them running in opposite directions, it flopped straight over as if they were not turning at all. The gyroscopic action of one is completely canceled by the other, and I can explain that, and there is no gyroscopic action left. Blew my mind when I saw that.
I guess I could see that. Yeah, cancellation. Cancels out. It balances itself out. In other words, and actually equals zero. Over.
Right, here's the next thing I did. I made a piano hinge arrangement. In other words, I connected a gyroscope to a metal frame. The metal frame came down to the tabletop with a piano hinge parallel to the tabletop. So now the gyroscope couldn't precess. In other words, it was restricted in one plane. It could only tilt over in one plane. I spun the gyroscope up to full speed, started it straight up and down, and then let go while it's in that metal frame connected to that piano hinge down at the bottom. What do you think happened, Mel?
I think that maybe what the piano hinge stood straight up with it with the gyroscope on it. Over.
I'll repeat this now. You've got a piano hinge. Let's assume that one side of the piano hinge is screwed down to the table, and the piano hinge is parallel to the table. The axis or the pin down the center of the piano hinge is parallel to the table. Now the other leaf of the piano hinge comes up to this metal frame that's holding the gyroscope. So the gyroscope is restricted. He can't precess in the normal circle that he precesses in. He's now able to only flop down in one direction. In other words, if my piano hinge has its pivot north-south, my gyroscope is now constrained in such a way that it can either swing to the right and go down to the ground, swing to the east, or it can swing to the left and go down to the ground. Started with the gyroscope straight up and down, strained with that piano hinge, spun it up to full speed, and let go, and what do you think happened?
I don't know. I think it would have stand straight up, Dick, over.
That's exactly what I would guess it would do. It fell straight over. And the rate at which it fell over did not change whether or not it was spinning or not. A gyroscope requires a minimum of 2 degrees of freedom. It's got to move in that peculiar manner. You've seen the way your top wobbles back and forth. You've seen the way your gyroscope wobbles back and forth. It must have that wobble capability in order to get the gyroscopic action. You constrain it so it can only move in one plane. Put it in one of the three axes of your XYZ coordinate system. You only allow it to pivot in one of those axes. There is no gyroscopic action left. And you have to dig a little bit deeper to find out why it acts that way. And it's very opposite of common sense. Anybody want to comment on that one?
I noticed if it's standing on the tip of my finger, it's actually wobbling, you say.
Absolutely. It is wobbling in a circular manner. If you think back, you've got in your brain the experience that explains it. Assume I've got a gyroscope spinning. Assume it's spinning clockwise top view. Assume that it's now, the bottom of it is into a little bit of a cup in the bottom and on top of your table, we'll say. And you're grabbing the top of the gyroscope with your finger. So it's spinning clockwise. The bottom is constrained so that it cannot translate. But it can pivot any way it wants. The bottom is constrained, cannot translate. You're grabbing the top of the gyroscope and you push it to the north. You push it north with your finger on the top of the gyroscope. Thereby, while I think about this, it will pivot to the east. You push north, it will pivot towards the east. It always moves at right angles to the fourth. If you then push it to the east, it will pivot toward the south. Push it to the south, it will pivot to the west. Push it to the west, it will pivot north. That's if it's spinning clockwise top view. If it's counterclockwise top view, it'll do the opposite. You push it north, it'll move west. Push it west, it'll move south, and so on. So, when the gyroscope is getting near the end of its wind-up, so to speak, and you see it moving in what looks like a circular manner, they call it precession, what's really happening is gravity is taking this device that's tilted a little bit over. Let's assume now it's tilted slightly toward the north, and gravity is trying to pivot it all the way to the north. It's the equivalent of you pushing with your finger to the north. It will move to the east. As it moves to the east, now gravity is trying to pull it down toward the east. It'll move to the south. You trace it all the way around, and you see why it makes those circles. It's a little bit complicated to explain why, but gyroscopic precession, it must have the freedom to move at right angles. And I'll tell you what the astronauts did with this later on. Anybody want to comment? I'm glad I read you.
You know, in a torpedo, after World War II, of course, a lot of surplus and stuff was around. Now, the gyroscope that came out of a torpedo was in a funny kind of a thing that it could twist and turn every which way. It was like free running inside this housing. So, basically, when they set the torpedo, what the heck did they adjust this thing to a certain way? I mean, did they lock it or... funny kind of bracket it originally came from. You discarded all that. You took the gyroscope out, but they stole them in New York and in surplus. They stole them like a block or something. What a piece of way that was made. Gee, that was a precision piece of equipment. You know, the bearings and everything. And I was wondering, how the heck did they set that torpedo over?
First of all, that cage that it was in is capable of moving in all kinds of directions. I call that a three-dimensional gimbal assembly. It probably has a fancier name than that. A three-dimensional gimbal assembly. So that, if the gyroscope wasn't spinning and you reach your hand in there, you can twist it clockwise, counterclockwise, north, south, east, west, whichever way you want. And because of that outer gimbal assembly, it's completely free to move in every one of those directions. By the way, the astronauts train in such a mechanism so that they can find out how they will react to weightlessness. And so, what I think they did is that just before the torpedo is put into the tube, or maybe after it's put into the launching tube, the gyroscope is completely caged and held in just the right position. When they're getting ready for launch, it is now aligned correctly with the torpedo, assuming that the whole submarine is aligned toward the target. You spin up the gyroscope, and now let go of the constraints on it so it's capable of moving in that gimbal assembly. And the pivots on that gimbal assembly are really potentiometers that are going to the servo mechanism that moves the fins. Now, if the torpedo deviates a little bit to the left, to the right, up or down, the gyroscope holds a steady position, but the gimbals will now sense by way of their potentiometers on the pivots the fact that a certain error signal occurred. It moves the fins vertically so that the error goes back towards zero. Beautiful servo mechanism, so that you are essentially using a kind of inertial guidance system, which you aim the torpedo in the right direction. Until it runs out of steam, it's going to go in that direction. Back to you, Hal.
Well, I don't know, because they fire the torpedoes, you know, I guess I've seen them. You know, sometimes you see in a movie that it seems like the torpedo comes out and then makes a turn and heads for the target. I don't know if that maybe is, you know, an optical illusion, but it seemed like, who the heck knows, with the torpedo, whether or not it seemed like it had some kind of guidance that they set up, because before they fire the torpedo, they take certain type of observations. You always used to hear them set the depth, set this, set angle on the bottle or whatever. You know, you see it in the movies and all. And I don't know. And they had a gadget in the submarine called the Torpedo Data Computer, TDC. Now, that set something. I know on the torpedo, and I was just couldn't imagine how the heck they do this. How do they set all this on the torpedo while this, you know, in the tube, over?
Okay, I'm going to make a guess on this one. I gave you the example if you want to make a zero-degree azimuth launch. Let's assume now the man at the conning tower is telling you that the target is 21.4 degrees clockwise compared to the reference of the axis of the submarine. So now your caging mechanism on that gyroscope is capable of tilting the gyroscope clockwise, 21.4 degrees, if that's the number I gave. Then you spin up the gyroscope. It holds that position from then on. At the instant you launch the torpedo, it knows it's got this great big error because the gyroscope is launched 21.4 degrees compared to the torpedo. It deflects its fins accordingly until all of a sudden the whole torpedo is now lined up with the axis of that gyroscope. That's one way it could be done. What do you think, Mel?
Truthfully, don't know. I know that I'm saying how the heck they set all this on the torpedo when it's sitting in the tube. Is there wires that are connected to it, a rod? I mean, how the heck did they make these adjustments to the torpedo, you know, to the target? I mean, I don't understand. How did they set if the boat was, you say, if the angle of the boat was one thing and the torpedo had to make a turn and go to the target? How did they make the adjustments in the torpedo initially, Dick, over?
Okay, here's one way you could do it. Assume now that that gimbal mechanism has a bunch of pivots, and each one of those pivots has a stepper motor. You adjust the stepper motors to tilt the gyroscope axis 21.4 degrees to the right, compared to the axis of the torpedo, compared to the axis of the submarine. So you've got a stepper motor in there that's stepping that gimbaling cage. So now the axis of the torpedo is aimed at the target, even though the torpedo is not. Then you release those stepper motors, you put them into the non-stepping mode, you release their magnets, an electromagnet, so it's now free running. You spin up the gyroscope in that direction. Now that's where the submarine, that's where the torpedo wants to go. The torpedo is wired through that gimbal mechanism through potentiometers to those fins with the servo driving motors, and that torpedo, after he's launched, after he's free, he's going to move his fins in such a way that the gyroscope now lines up with the torpedo. It's the other way around. The fins operate in such a way to force the torpedo to be lined up with the axis of the gyroscope. And before the launch, you gave the command to force the axis of the gyroscope to be right in line with the target. That's one way it could be done, in my opinion, back in the days before we had good, fancier inertial guidance system. Just a simple gyroscope would do it, and some other kind of a pressure sensor would sense whether or not you're at the right depth. That's you, man.
We don't even know how they fired the torpedo once it's in that tube. You know, what starts the machine running? I thought, do they have a plug? Do they plug it in, you know, the torpedo? Do they stick a plug in? And so that when he says fire the torpedo, he pushes the button. What sets the machine, you know, the motors going in the torpedo? I assume, what do they put inside the tube? I guess they got maybe a plug that plugs into the torpedo when it's inserted into the firing tube, Dick, over.
I doubt it. Wiring in a situation like that would be very unreliable. There's water all over the place. I would never want to wire something in there. In the heat of battle, when everybody is all excited and the guy forgets to plug that in, oh boy, are you going to shoot him? No. First of all, the torpedo leaves its tube by way of an extremely high pressure pulse of air. You press that fire button on the back end of that door of the torpedo tube and you're releasing compressed air. A tremendous amount of compressed air goes into the back of the torpedo, and so any water that's out in front of it, when you open up those doors, the water gets forced out of the way, and the torpedo itself is a tight fit in that tube, and you're firing that thing out of that tube like a piston. Not too different from what happens with gunpowder moving a projectile. That blast of air, I am guessing, is sensed by the back end of the torpedo, and that pressure of that blast of air closes a switch that sets the whole thing in motion. That's my guess. Back to you, Mel.
Thanks. I guess I can say down to a science how they did it. Not really up on how they. I just was amazed that, you know, in that tube, like you say, the compressed air fires it out. The torpedo motor starts and goes on course and hits its target, supposedly. Yeah, you know, I don't really know, but I remember they were selling parts like that, torpedo parts, in the city. There was a guy that surplus there. I'm trying to remember. Was he found the canal street? I think, oh, he had all kinds of junk. And in fact, you know what I did? I bought a bomb sight, even, from a B-29. It was the B-29 bomb sight, that famous bomb sight that, oh, it had motors and switches and things. And all kinds of optics on it and all, and I remember I took that all apart. You'd buy the bomb site like for $5 a thing, a big chunk of equipment, and they had all kinds of stuff to get to the war. They were selling off surplus, so I just remember that these different things are very fascinating, you know, that I had so much fun fooling with these different items that they, you know, that came out of World War II, Dick, over.
Yeah, some of that surplus equipment that became available after World War II was real fun. I've got a friend who I think is still alive, but I'm not sure, living in Nassau, who described to me the way he survived a submarine accident. During World War II, his particular submarine lost lift capability, went down to the bottom of the ocean, and was stuck. It wasn't in very deep ocean, but it was down to the bottom ocean, and they were stuck, and they weren't going to come up. And so each of the guys volunteered to get into the torpedo tube and be blasted out of the torpedo tube up to the surface. Not all of them lived. And the last guy sacrificed his life and sat there and inside the submarine and pushed the last button for the last guy and stayed there and died. This buddy of mine got blasted out of that torpedo tube, and he was given lots of warning ahead of time to close off his nose and mouth the best he could to make sure it wouldn't do anything nasty to his lungs. He succeeded in doing that. It blew out his eardrums. But he did survive and get up to the surface by being blasted out of a torpedo tube. Back to you, Mel.
That doesn't sound like a fun experience. Gee, yeah, I can imagine. I don't think I'd ever be ready for submarine duty. It wouldn't be my cup of tea because I think I'd get... I once, you know, went into the city, they had a submarine there. And they had the, you know, the amateur radio operators on there. It was, you know, one of the, I think it was some, for the Veterans Day? No. Armed Forces Day? I think it was Armed Forces Day. Yeah, well, I went aboard the carrier, also the Intrepid, which the kids had a lot of fun with. And we went on to a cruiser there. They had a destroy, and we went down onto that submarine there. And boy, I'll tell you something. It's close quarters, pipes and things all over the place and all. And I'll tell you, I don't know if I'd want to be in one of those tin cans, Dick. That looks like an overgrown boiler to me. It's very strange feeling in there. I guess very hard to get used to as far as I'm concerned over.
I'll pick up that other person in a minute. Can you imagine a person with the smallest amount of claustrophobia in an environment like that? And they're making a deep dive, and he's hearing that creaking sound of the all the metal of the submarine being deflected. Guarantee that guy's going to be uncomfortable. Who is it was that just joined us?
Charlie, KC2MPY. I just want to make a comment. Your explanation of how the torpedo works matches exactly with a website I just found describing a World War II torpedo, where they set the gyroscope to the heading that they want the torpedo to take relative to the tube, and then fire it out, and the rudders then cause the torpedo to realign to the angle of the gyro and take the heading that the gyro was turned to.
I was lucky on that one, Charlie. That was a pure guess on my part as to a possible way of doing it. I'm a little bit afraid that it was too simplistic, so I think you're saying real World War II submarine torpedoes actually operated by some process like that. And did they explain how they cranked in the angle on the gyroscope? I guess that it could be done with a stepper motor. I guess I can think of some ways that you could set some dials and do it mechanically. Back to you, Charlie.
According to this site, it could be done manually by the torpedo man prior to loading it into the tube. And it was driven, according to this, by compressed air. That's what ran the gyroscope.
Okay, so that kept the gyroscope spinning. I think compressed air also provided the raw power to deflect the fins. And I think the main motor, in many cases, was running on a silver-zinc battery, a very high-energy battery for that day. I think that was the main propulsion, but I'm not sure about that one. Back to you, Charlie.
The propulsion system I was familiar with, I know what made that work. There were steam engines. They burned alcohol, and they created steam. And the engine was a small steam engine which drove the propellers. That was something I had remembered from, I don't know where, but this confirms that still is actually the case.
So, I guess you're saying there was a bottle of oxygen going into the alcohol burner, which created the heat, which boiled the water, or boiled some substance, that made steam, that ran a steam engine, and that provided the raw power for the main propulsion system. I'm guessing it also had counter-rotating props. Back to you, Charlie.
Yeah, according to this diagram, it's got counter-rotating props. It didn't burn oxygen. That compressed air chamber was also the source of the air for the alcohol fire, which created the steam. And that's what drove the counter-rotating propellers. Yeah, exactly.
Now, in order to bring the alcohol burner up to temperature where you're boiling the water, you would think there would be a significant delay time, like at least 20 or 30 seconds to heat up a small little chunk of water. Does that mean that the torpedo, you put it into the ready mode where it starts heating up its steam engine assembly? And does that mean that it's either building up pressure or the props are turning in the tube even before you launch? What do you think on that one?
Yeah, I think so. I'm just reading about exactly about firing up the thing and about firing the torpedo. I know that that steam engine was started significantly before the torpedo was actually launched. I think it's not correct to believe that you could say, oh, let's launch a torpedo, and back in World War II, and 5 seconds later, the torpedo was on its way, like a mortar or howitzer round. I have a feeling that's not how it is. I'm trying to find that out here to see if they actually say what the startup time on a torpedo might actually be.
Excellent.
Go ahead. Give us your caller's name, sir.
KC202Y with a question, not relevant right now for this discussion, but I have a question about a battery.
I think it was KC2 Obo Tango Yankee is what it sounds like. My name is Dick. Go ahead. What's your name, sir?
Charlie 2 Lima Tango Yankee called. Rich is the name.
Go ahead with your battery question, Rich.
You have a AA battery, and it's fully charged, and drop it on the concrete floor. It will bounce so hard, say 6 inches, and take the identical battery, deplete it of energy, drop it on a concrete floor, it will drop an inch. You ever seen such a test?
No, I haven't. Right now, I don't have an explanation for that one. I guess as you consume the chemistry inside by really using the cell, you could be changing the internal pressure, which has something to do with the way it bounces, but that's a pure guess on my part.
That's it. What makes the battery bounce higher, fully charged, versus the battery that's depleted of energy bounce lower, off of a concrete floor? And, an electrician friend of mine said that the battery is depleted of electrolyte, whatever. And that's the only explanation.
Have you actually seen this experiment yourself? Were the two batteries of identical brand name? And when you throw them against the floor, you got a big problem. Is it going to land tip down, tip up, sideways, some other crazy angle? To make hit the concrete floor twice the same way, that isn't easy if it's a throw down. Back to you, Rich.
The test was done on identical batteries, and the batteries right and dropped them to land the long way of the battery, so it was landing flat, you know, not end to end. So the battery landed the longest distance measured, landed flat, not end on to end. So the negative end or the positive end did not land face first, landed flat. And the battery, a fully charged battery, will bounce up 6 inches, and a depleted battery will bounce up off the floor an inch.
Rich, are you in an automobile that is idling? Rich, that question was directed to you. Are you in an automobile that is idling? The reason I asked that question is hearing a little bit of a motorboating sound, as if it was an alternator running. Either that or your particular PL does have a little bit of a peculiar sound to it. Okay, I'm going to think about that one some more. And I bet you it took at least 30 seconds, maybe even a minute or a minute and a half, to have some ready time for that torpedo before you really do a launch. What do you think, Charlie?
If it was steam-powered, I would think that. I've just found some others that are actually driven by a four-cylinder radial engine of 350 horsepower. So I have a feeling they've certainly gone through a lot of technological improvements of how torpedoes actually work over the years, so I can't imagine what drives them today.
That 350 horsepower four-cylinder engine, was that an internal combustion engine running on gasoline and compressed air?
Well, this particular thing I'm reading here doesn't go into quite that depth, but it's showing a four-cylinder radial engine, 350 horsepower, and it's got a, the one interesting thing is that the one common thing for all of them, of these vintage, I guess, is they had to have an air chamber to supply the air for the combustion process of the motor, which was pretty obvious, and it's almost something you don't think about right off the top, that they have to carry their own air supply, as well as the smallest thing, which is the warhead.
Absolutely. And this brings up that subject I had 6 months or so ago, where I was advocating that although the president said we're going to go back to the moon and on to Mars, sounds good, it is my belief that your children will not see an astronaut standing on Mars. And it's not because we don't have the technology to do it. We don't have the raw resources in consumables to do it. You are continuously breathing air, oxygen mostly. You're giving out all kinds of gases like carbon dioxide and methane. You're consuming water and food. The raw materials that go into your body in 1 year is roughly the volume of your household and roughly the mass of your house. That's what goes through your body as a processing plant in 1 year. And a Mars trip is a 3-year trip for an astronaut. So 3 households worth of materials, consumables, are required to maintain each individual astronaut on a Mars trip. No way in hell can you take the mass of 3 households per human being and pack it in there and have enough booster power to get all of that material to Mars. Therefore, you have no choice but to do recycling. Rolls off the tongue real easily. Can you imagine the degree of difficulty of taking every single molecule of gas, liquid, and solid emitted by a human being for a solid 3 years and reprocess that perfectly back into consumable oxygen, consumable fluid, water, and consumable food, and do that with perfect accuracy for 3 solid years without that machinery breaking down? This Earth does a beautiful job of recycling every single molecule that goes into you and out of you. Every single breath of air you take contains molecules of air that were at one time inside of the lungs of every single human being and every single animal that has ever lived on this planet. You're recycling every single molecule. So on that spaceship, you've got to do that. Wow, is that difficult in my mind. Therefore, even if we had the booster power to get the man and the machinery there, the problem of the consumables that we keep forgetting about is huge. A Progress ship with tons of fuel, tons of materials, comes up to the International Space Station every couple of weeks to maintain those astronauts. Tremendous amounts of material.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
A tremendous number of consumables are brought up to that space station to maintain those astronauts because we have not yet perfected anywhere near the requirement in consumable reprocessing. I once wrote a memo to this subject and tried to publish it on the website for the Long Island Astronomical Society. And boy, did those guys get mad at me. They didn't say why they were mad. They didn't want to hear that. Apparently, one possible guess is I was giving them a truth that was too painful. Every single high school student is dreaming about the time that one of his fellow astronauts will walk the surface of Mars. I am skeptical as to whether or not our grandchildren will ever see that. That's an opinion. KQIIW.
Yeah, you know, I've listened to you talk about this several times. I listen virtually every single weekend. And I've heard you go over it, and I've sit here and listened with great interest to what you say, and fundamentally I agree with everything you're saying. But being that I've always been interested in astronomy also since I was a kid and had so many telescopes, and I still do, you don't want to really believe that's so. And I'm somewhere between saying you're absolutely right and saying you're absolutely wrong, but I somehow believe it to be a matter of scale. Certainly on the size spacecraft that we're used to, space shuttle size things, I think you're absolutely right. The scale seems to just be wrong. If you could get something up into space at some time in the future, and you're right about it, it may not be my grandchildren's future either, but if you can get something in space the size of an aircraft carrier, again, maybe we're talking too much Star Wars, then maybe it's possible.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, Charlie, and to a certain degree, I'd like to be wrong. So maybe I shouldn't word it quite as strongly as I do. Maybe I should just say this is the major challenge that's got to be solved before we're going to get a man on Mars. And considering the resources required to do it, I'll bet you and I could come up with a plan of action that in today's dollars might require $200 billion as a project to get a man onto Mars. I don't think any one nation can do it. It's going to be a consortium of many nations. And then you have to ask yourself, is that cost effective? If you look at the tremendous amount of data we're getting out of Spirit and Opportunity, those remotely piloted vehicles on Mars, boy, that's a nice way to go. Should we invest $200 or $300 billion of the resources of two or three, of maybe 20 or 50, 10 or 20 nations, it'd have to be a worldwide project, to put a man onto a planet that is essentially the driest, coldest desert you and I can imagine? Would we get enough out of that human being standing there for a few months compared to Spirit and Opportunity standing there for a couple of years? And the chances of that astronaut coming back alive, I think, is awful small. So such a huge investment today, by today's standards, in dollars and risk of life, for not that much return on investment, I think it's a bit difficult to justify today. Now, I hope we keep developing the technology, reprocessing, better, more efficient rocket engines, higher specific impulse fuels, and so on. Obviously, we're moving in that direction. But the requirements here, by my standards, are so large that I just want people to admit ahead of time how difficult it is. One of my philosophies is that quite often people like to oversimplify. And in many situations, if you think the problem is simple, you probably don't understand the problem. Very few things are truly simple when you get down to really doing it. I'll admit this sounds kind of negative. KQLIW.
Station 4021.
OTY, go ahead there, Rich.
Yes, I was asking before about the battery dropping on the floor. What's your explanation?
I don't have one, Rich. I'm guessing that the fully charged battery has higher internal pressure. Therefore, when it gets deflected by the floor, it's got a little bit higher coefficient of restitution, they call it. That's the way a ball bounces, the efficiency by which a ball bounces. But that's a guess. Are you sure you have seen with your own eyes a battery that you know was charged and you watched the guy put it on some kind of a meter that measured its current output capability? And then you took an uncharged one, a dead one, which he put on some kind of a current meter, and you saw that the current meter really was much, much lower than the first case. And then you saw those two batteries dropped simultaneously, flat, on the same concrete floor, and you saw the one with the red mark on it bounce higher. Did all of those steps take place in front of your eyes, Rich? Go ahead, sir.
Okay. It was a battery in a radio depleted, and it's battery brand new, dropped not simultaneously, but one after the other, and the fully charged battery bounced higher than the dead battery. And an electrician friend of mine told me that the reason for this was the battery that was charged had more electrons, more mass in that sector than the dead battery.
Okay, you go to the right website, Rich, and you're going to find a big hole in that theory. I can take that car battery of mine on a cold winter day, and at the instant I turn that key and I'm trying to start that dead, dead rotor starter motor, 200 amperes flow. Tremendous number of electrons you would think flow out of that battery. Absolutely, positively not. That battery does not supply one single electron or one single positron. That battery is a pump for every single electron that comes out of the negative lead, the exact same number of electrons must go into the positive lead. It is a pure pump. Not one single electron has ever left independently any battery you or I have ever used. You and I are into an area where a tremendous number of people have a misconception of what a generator is. Long Island Lighting Company and Con Ed does not supply one single electron. They pump electrons. They don't supply them. They don't create them. There is no change in mass in that battery because of the electrons leaving. Not one left, independent of the ones that came in. Back to you, Rich.
Oh. I swear to God, and I've seen this 100 times, taking a AA battery, fully charged, dropping it from 24 inches to a concrete floor, and it bounced 6 inches, and take the identical battery and used in a little radio, depleted of its energy, and drop it on the floor and it bounced a half an inch. And I've seen this done 100 times. Fact.
I'm going to take your word for it, Rich. I'm going to take your word for it that you witnessed that. That it did bounce higher, and that one was charged and one was uncharged. I'm going to take your word for it that you really did see that. You and I are left without an explanation yet as to what it is. It cannot be more electrons in one versus the other. Now, depletion of the chemistry and some kind of a changes of internal pressure, I would accept that. A change in mass, I'm having trouble with. If you weighed, carefully weighed that dead battery, and you weighed that fully charged battery, because they are extremely well sealed, because if they weren't well sealed, they would be depositing acid inside your flashlight and eating it up like crazy. They're very well sealed. No chemistry leaves that battery. No electrons independently leave that battery. Now, because of the chemistry that goes on, there may be a change in internal pressure, but I think the mass on a non-damaged battery must be the same. If you weigh a dead one and you weigh a live one, they better weigh the same, because they're not supplying electrons. They're only pumping them. You see where I'm going with this one, Rich? KC2OTY, K2LIW.
Imbalance on a position.
Somebody said something, but I didn't understand it.
The fully charged battery and the depleted battery, okay, they should weigh the same. I agree with you. Now, you have one battery that has 1.5 volts, and you drop it and it bounces 6 inches off the floor. That's fully charged. Identical battery, if it's been used in a radio, depleted of its energy, will bounce a half an inch off the floor. Now, we did not drain anything out of it other than electricity, correct? Now, why does it have a different characteristic on bouncing off a concrete floor? That's my question.
I don't think anybody here has got a good answer for you, Rich. You've thrown out a damn good mystery, assuming it's correct. And you sound like you're very honest and that you did see it with your own eyes. I'm going to believe you. And, when I get a chance, I'm going to run the experiment myself. But no, you say depleted of electricity, as if electricity flowed out of the battery. It didn't. It's only a pump. When that car battery of yours is dishing out 200 amperes, one of the questions that I've often asked people is, when that red electron comes out of the negative lead and it's heading toward your starter motor, and it's got 3 feet of wire to go to, how long does it take to get there? If the starter motor could run continuously, and if the battery could issue that current continuously, the answer is 4 hours. That piece of big, wide blade between your battery and that starter motor is a pipe. You push one electron into one end of the pipe, and one electron pops out of the other end of the pipe. It's like a pipe with a bunch of marbles. Mother Nature forces balance. She will not let one electron flow out of the end of the cable until you put one electron into the cable. If you were allowed to drain all the free electrons, so-called free electrons, that are in that copper cable, you could get that current flowing out of that cable for 4 solid hours, not connected to the battery. Mother Nature won't let you do that. She won't let you create that unbalance and rip out those electrons. That battery is only an electron pump. It's pushing electrons in one particular direction. But for every electron that leaves the battery, one must go in. For every electron that leaves that copper cable, one must go in. Mother Nature forces complete balance at every instant along that piece of cable, within the 3 nanoseconds of the speed of light along the cable. That's a true statement. So the total amount of material inside of that battery of yours stayed the same. The total number of electrons and protons, everything stayed the same in mass. Maybe because of the chemical action, a change in pressure occurred. Maybe because of the chemical action, the stiffness of the materials got modified. Some of the materials that used to be on the carbon rod down the center are now deposited on the zinc on the outside. If it was a Laclanche, old-fashioned type dry cell, as we used to call them. So some of the materials moved from one place to another in the battery in the process of the chemical action of the pumping taking place. But the total amount of materials are the same. In the case of an old-fashioned battery, the zinc outer can sort of got eaten up. And so the zinc outer can on a fresh battery would be a lot more stiff than it is on a depleted old-fashioned dry cell. So I could see how you would have a difference there, and maybe something similar is going on with a modern-day manganese dioxide or whatever it is that's inside of these modern alkaline batteries. And I presume it's an alkaline Duracell or something like that we're talking about here. But I could ask all of the electronic engineers in the companies where I work, do the electrons come out of the battery when it's connected to a circuit? And their answer would be yes. Very few of them realize it is only a pump, and Mother Nature will not allow you to issue one without another one going in. So we're still certainly lacking an explanation, and you phone out a beautiful puzzle here, Rich. KC2OTY, K2RW in the group.
IVL with a comment.
Hey, Dick, I'll tell you right now, for a fact, I can take a fully charged AA battery on 1.5 volts and drop it from 2 feet onto a concrete floor. It will bounce up 6 inches off the floor. And you take the same battery and use it in a little radio for a week and deplete the energy from the battery. And I take that battery and drop it on from the same distance onto the same concrete floor. And it's going to bounce off the floor an inch. And it's dead. That's the way we did it. That's how it was done. I can light cigarettes with batteries. You know? Using a wire. And I've done this for 6 months. I know. This is no bullshit. I know. I've done it. It's a fact.
IVL with a comment.
I believe you, Eric.
Good morning. The time is 12:01 a.m.
K2RW, WCDL.
Go ahead, Andy.
Andy, is this
for the 12. If you want to give me a call, could you do it quickly? Because I got to get up early tomorrow.
Okay, I better sign off and give you a call right now. Bye-bye, you guys. I'll see you next week. Thank you for all your contributions.